Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, this is Jad. Just popping in to let you know that the story that you're about to hear was first put out in 2013. And since that time, an amazing documentary series called Making a Murderer landed, which focused on this same story that you're about to hear, actually just on one piece of the story that comes up toward the end. It's an aspect of the story we didn't really focus on too much, but they go super deep on it. So what we're going to do is we're going to play you the story as we put it out, and then we'll update it a tiny bit with a conversation with the filmmakers. So here's the story as we first aired it, podcasted it in 2013. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're still talking about certainty versus doubt. And in this final story, the two once again collide, but this time it's in a way that's almost unimaginable.
I remember running along railroad track, a seldom used railroad track, but just thinking, God, it would be a blessing if a train just came along and flattened me. It was like...
We need to warn you now, if there are young or sensitive listeners listening right now, this next piece depicts graphic violence and it can be pretty disturbing. So if you're listening with kids, this would be a good time to ask them to leave the room or... for you to put on headphones.
This piece comes from our producer, Pat Walters.
I guess we could just start at the beginning. So could you just, set the scene? It was 1985?
Yes, it was 1985.
So this is Penny.
Penny Burnson.
And in 1985, Penny and her husband, Tom.
Yeah, I'm here.
We're living in Wisconsin.
On the shores of Lake Michigan.
In a little town called Manitowoc.
Owned a small third generation family business.
And what kind of business was that?
Burnson's Candies. It opened 7 days a week, 10 to 10, 363 days a year.
But sometimes in the summer, Penny and Tom would cut out early and...
go to the beach. That's where we went that day.
July 29th, 1985.
Blue skies, probably in the 70s. Perfect day to be at the beach with your family.
They parked the car.
2-3 o'clock in the afternoon and...
set up camp near the water.
And I was reading a book about Lizzie Borden, the infamous axe murderer.
But after about like an hour of reading this book, Penny set it down and
said to my husband, I can't believe I'm reading this gruesome book on a beautiful day. I'm going to go for a jog.
Penny heads north along the water.
And when I was within about a half mile of my starting point, there was a guy standing with a leather jacket slung over his shoulder. And as I jogged by, he said, it's a great day. I glanced at him and said, it's a beautiful day for a jog. Didn't really think anything of it. Jogged 3 miles, turned around, and I saw
same guy
come out from under a half-fallen tree and head towards me.
She started to run. And we should say this next part gets graphic and violent.
Made the mistake of running into the water to try and get away from him and realized how slowly I was running in the water. As I ran back to the beach, this man caught up with me, put me in a chokehold, and said, we're going to take a little walk up into the sand dunes. He pushed me up over this first sand dune where we were no longer visible to anybody, started asking me to do sexual things. He was trying to remove my swimsuit, and I twisted to try and get away, and he tightened his grip and said, do what I tell you, I've got a knife. Two thoughts went through my mind. Stay really calm and get a good look at this guy. Caucasian, sandy blonde hair, curly beard and mustache, hairy hands, short stubby fingers. He pushed me down on the ground and was kneeling over me. And when I was refusing, what he would do was strangle me until I would about lose consciousness. Then he would loosen his grip and say, now are you going to do it? And I would refuse. And as I'm talking, I managed to get one leg up and I kicked him in the groin. But unfortunately, it didn't incapacitate him. It enraged him. Yeah. And he said, no, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
Meanwhile, Tom is getting worried.
Because she was so predictable in her patterns. She would normally be gone 45 minutes to an hour.
After an hour and a half, he started pacing the beach.
At 2 hours.
He called the cops.
The police brought in jet skis.
Were you thinking that she'd...
I was fairly convinced that she probably had drowned. In Manitowoc, you don't think about crime. You didn't lock your doors. You didn't, you know, many people left their keys in their car.
He started hitting my head either on a rock or a tree stump, some hard object. At one point, he broke my nose and then strangled me till I lost consciousness.
Sometime later, Penny woke up.
When I came to, I was lying on my back in the sand.
She saw that she was naked and alone.
I thought maybe he's in the woods, you know, watching to see if I've survived or if he's accomplished what he set out to do. So I tried to stand up, was too weak, and fell over.
And she noticed when she fell down that her hands were covered in blood.
And I thought, this is evidence. I need to preserve this. So I crawled through the sand kind of on my knees and the heels of my hands.
Making sure she was keeping her fingers up out of the sand.
As soon as I saw her, I knew that she had been beaten. You never want to see someone like that, and you know, I hope I never see that again.
The paramedics rushed Penny to the ER. Next thing she remembers, she was lying in a hospital bed surrounded by doctors and nurses.
Stitching facial cuts, and then there's a female deputy who's questioning me.
She asked Penny to describe the guy.
Caucasian, sandy blonde hair, curly, hairy hands, stubby fingers.
And the next morning, the cops brought Penny down to the police station for a lineup.
And this is where you like go into a room and there's a one-way mirror.
You can see them, they can't see you.
There were 9 guys.
Each of the 9 had a number around their neck from 1 to 9.
She looked at one guy, then another, then another.
And when I came to, I don't know if he was number 3, I don't recall exactly.
One particular guy of the 9.
The hair on the back of my neck stood up. I remember the color draining from my face, visceral gut reaction, like, oh my God, this is the guy.
Barely any time had passed since the attack. She was positive. The sheriff wasn't surprised. They'd had their eye on this guy for a while. His name was Stephen Avery. He'd been arrested for some small-time stuff, burglary, cruelty to animals, and most recently,
an attempted assault at rifle point.
He pulled a gun on a woman.
So
the DA indicted him for attacking Penny. The trial was fast.
Very fast.
Penny got on the stand and said,
I was 100% certain that Stephen Avery was the man who assaulted me.
She had no doubt. She looked people squarely in the eye. Her recollections were unequivocal. She was a very strong witness.
This is Fred Hazelwood. He was the judge on the case.
Here in Manitowoc County.
Tell me about his alibi.
His alibi was that he just didn't have the time to commit the crime.
Because he was shopping.
He bought some paint, I believe, or drywall compound, I'm not sure what. He was also working that day before the alleged assault, helping his family pour cement for some project at home. That was his testimony and the testimony of a whole bunch of other witnesses.
16. Only problem was nearly all of them were family.
And the stories were too similar.
This is Tom again.
Virtually identical.
It sounded like they had gotten together and talked.
That was a credibility issue that affected the defense witnesses.
And there was one other big problem for Avery, his clothes.
There was not a microscopic speck of concrete dust on any of the clothes that he wore that day. And he indicated at the trial that he had worked the end of the concrete chute. Well, anyone that has ever done that at the end of a concrete truck knows that that just comes out and splashes.
After deliberating for 2 days, the jury found Steve Avery guilty.
Guilty on 3 counts, as I recall.
Yeah. Sexual assault.
15 years.
Attempted murder.
15 years.
And I believe false imprisonment.
2 years for false imprisonment.
32 years altogether.
To be served consecutively.
So you go back to the chocolate shop and try to carry on with life as it was before?
Right. Essentially.
But that obviously wasn't so easy.
Nightmares, flashbacks.
She was angry.
You know, blowing up at my kids.
Her husband.
Sometimes I would want my husband to be protective, and other times he would think he was being protective, and I would say, like, I can take care of myself.
When a guy in the street whistled at her?
I turned around and just let loose with every obscenity in the book. Yeah. You know?
She started seeing a therapist, which helped a little. But even a year after Steve's conviction, she was still struggling with all this anger.
And then one snowy afternoon,
maybe winter of 86, 87,
she went to see a talk by this social worker,
Dr. Mark Umbright from the University of Minnesota. And I don't remember exactly what he said. I don't think he used the word forgiveness, but he said at some point, victims reached the point where they understand that the anger and hatred they're feeling is really damaging themselves and their families, and they need to let go of it. And I left the presentation at the next break. I went home, I got my cross-country skis. I went to Point Beach State Park and skied to the point where I was, exact spot where I'd been assaulted, and basically said to myself, Steve, you don't have power over me anymore. So that was a turning point.
Penny actually started working in the prisons. She'd go and tell inmates her story,
hoping to teach the impact of crime and hope that they might make the leap to changing their behavior.
Meanwhile,
Stephen Avery has a number of appeals, and he's turned down at all his appeals.
She had told the district attorney,
if anyone so much as breathes Stephen Avery's name in court, I want to be notified and I want to be there for every hearing. And I did show up. And I'm getting more and more angry every time there's appeal. Like, is there no finality? Is there no closure to this?
He kept asking the court to review the evidence over and over again.
And I'm thinking, why is he so persistent?
And then one Sunday morning,
in early September,
in 2003, 18 years after Steve Avery's conviction, Penny gets a call from her lawyer friend, Janine.
And Janine has called and said, can I stop by? I want to talk to you about a restorative justice initiative at Marquette.
Which frankly was the truth, but it wasn't why I was driving to Manitowoc on a Sunday.
On her way, Janine called Penny's husband, who had left town for a business trip that morning.
Janine told me what she had just discovered and heard.
It was about a DNA test. She asked Tom to turn around.
Tom and I both pulled into the driveway
together
simultaneously.
I walk outside, and both of them are ashen.
And in that moment,
she knew.
I knew instantly.
All I always remember the look on her face.
The DNA is back. It is not Stephen Avery.
She just fell apart. I told her I wanted to go in and sit down, and she went and sat on the couch next to Tom. And
explained to her, the Wisconsin Innocence Project had reevaluated some of the biological material from the crime scene.
Some hairs.
And determined
that an innocent person has spent 18 years, I think it was 18 years, 1 month and 13 days in prison for something he did not do.
You know, she looked very frightened. And I said, Penny, I want you to remember all the good you've done.
Working in the prisons, all the men you've reached.
You know, I mean, she didn't say much.
I remember feeling if I wrote down every good deed I had done from the day I was born until today, it would not possibly be sufficient to balance the scales in terms of this horrendous error that I've made. That day was worse than the day I was assaulted.
And there was one more thing.
Then I learned not only was there an exoneration, but there was a hit.
The court told Penny that the DNA belonged to a man
named Gregory Allen,
who at that moment was imprisoned for
a very brutal rape of a woman in Green Bay, Wisconsin. He'd actually been charged with an attempted assault on the same beach where I was assaulted. His nickname was the Sandman because he liked to come up over the sand dunes and grab someone.
And for 10 years, while Steve Avery was in prison, he'd walked free.
So I'm thinking, how many other women have had their lives turned upside down and inside out because I misidentified the man who assaulted me?
As it turned out, Gregory Allen was serving his sentence, a 60-year sentence.
At the prison in Green Bay,
where Penny had actually been working.
And as a matter of fact, he was about 2 weeks from being in Penny's next class.
No way.
And no, absolutely. And so Penny would never have known this man that would have been sitting feet away from her. In his cell, they found a scrapbook where he had documented all the appeals of Stephen Avery over all those years.
Oh, that's really creepy.
That's more than creepy.
September 11th, 2003, Steve Avery was set free. As soon as he walked out of the gate of the prison, he was mobbed by reporters.
It was the news story in Wisconsin, and he was considered a celebrity. There was a legislator who actually put together a Stephen Avery fund that people can contribute to, because he really had no resources and no job skills because he's been in prison for 18 years. You know, there was a beauty salon in Green Bay that gave him a makeover. I remember sending my husband out of town and saying, no, I just need to be alone. And I decided I'm going out running. And I remember running along railroad track, a seldom used railroad track, but just thinking, God, it would be a blessing if a train just came along and flattened me. It was like, what do I do? I can't make this right.
She says every time she saw Stephen Avery's face,
he was on the front page of our local Manitowoc newspaper every day for 2 to 3 weeks.
Two things would happen. She'd think, how could I have done this to this man? But at the very same moment she thought that,
the hair on the back of my neck would stand up.
Even
after I knew intellectually he was innocent. But emotionally, this is the man who I've seen in my nightmares and flashbacks for 18 years.
So those 2 weeks after, where his face is in the paper every day, must have been very strange.
It was strange.
Yeah.
And then it's also strange to feel like an offender. A little aside here, when I saw Gregory Allen's picture, the picture of my actual perpetrator, there was absolutely no physical reaction from me. I would swear I'd never seen him before in my life. So my therapist said to me, you will never be able to attach to Gregory Allen the feelings you had towards Stephen Avery. What you have to do is work on removing those feelings from Steve and looking at Steve as, this is an innocent person.
Not long after his exoneration, Penny had written to Steve asking if she could meet him and apologize in person. And about a year and a half after his exoneration, he agreed.
I was so nervous.
Can you set the scene? Are you in like
a
little
room?
We're in a
very small office, like a two-room office.
In a legislative building in the state capitol.
There's a sofa and a few chairs.
Penny got there first. Eventually, Steve walked in.
Steve had his attorney, Keith Finley, there from the Innocence Project. I stand up, I extend my hand to Steve. He gives me this hearty handshake. Our lives have been intertwined for almost 2 decades, and it's the first time we've physically
touched.
He sits down. We talked about things like he had a nephew who was killed in a car accident when he was in prison and couldn't go to the funeral. His grandmother died. He couldn't go to her funeral. His wife had divorced him. He's estranged from his children. At some of them, I know he had one daughter who really stood by him. So I brought up these losses and
apologized for each one individually.
He's very quiet, sort of just acknowledged him with a nod of his head. And he said, I don't blame you, I blame the police.
Because it turned out in the weeks before Penny was attacked, the police had been watching Gregory Allen.
Because he was a known sex offender. They were actually tailing him for the 2 weeks prior to my assault, checking on him sometimes as often as a dozen times a day. On July 29th, 1985, the day I was assaulted, they checked on him once in the morning, and then due to a high volume of police calls, were unable to check on him anymore that day, and that's the afternoon I was assaulted.
Eventually, after Penny and Steve had been sitting in that little room for a while,
time was up and there was no more to be said. And I stood up and walked over to Steve and said to Steve, is it okay if I give you a hug? And he didn't even respond. He just grabbed me in a big bear hug. And I said, so only he could hear, Steve, I'm so sorry. And he said, it's okay. This is over. And for him to say, it's okay, it's over, when I know full well his journey's just beginning, and he's got a hell of a road.
Yeah.
That's one of the most grace-filled things that's ever been said to me. Fast forward.
About 2 years after that meeting,
I get a call from Janine Geske, my attorney friend.
The one who delivered the news about the exoneration.
Who says,
something's happened.
There's a woman photographer who's missing.
Teresa Halbach disappeared October 31st after visiting the suspect, Stephen Avery, to take pictures of a car he was selling.
And they are searching the Avery property.
I encouraged her. I tried to tell her, stay out of this.
But Penny went on the local news.
And said,
I cannot believe this.
That she didn't believe it could be Stephen Avery, that she didn't believe he would be capable of such a thing.
And other people in town thought that too, that this was just another false accusation.
But eventually, after a couple of days of searching, the remains of Teresa's body,
burned human bone and teeth,
were eventually found in a burn barrel at the Avery Auto Salvage Yard.
Stephen Avery claimed that he was innocent, that he was set up by the police. But a few months later, his nephew came forward. And he tells police in an interrogation that the day of the murder, he went to Stephen Avery's trailer. He heard screams inside. Stephen came to the door in a t-shirt and gym shorts. He was sweating. And inside, the nephew sees Teresa Halbach bound to the bed. And what happens next, according to Stephen's nephew, is one of the most awful things I've ever heard. Stephen asks his nephew to rape Teresa with him. And then together, they kill her.
Oh my God. You start questioning your own judgment. I can't even trust my senses. I can't trust my eyes to tell me what I thought I recorded accurately about the world. And then when he gets convicted for killing Teresa, it's like, what kind of character judge am I? Now I can't even judge character. I can't.
She'd been certain twice and wrong twice. And then a worse thought occurred to her.
Would Teresa Halbach be alive today if I hadn't misidentified my assailant?
Meaning what exactly? Like,
well, I accuse Steve of something he doesn't do. He's convicted. He spends 18 years in prison. Prison is enormously damaging to guilty people. What happens to someone who's innocent?
In other words, did her initial certainty that Steve Avery was her assailant, did that turn him into the guy who murdered Teresa Halbach?
No.
Judge Hazelwood doesn't buy that argument.
Not at all. Not at all.
For one, if you look at the group of people who've been set free after a wrongful conviction, the vast majority of them do okay. They don't commit serious crimes after they've been released from prison. And this was a man with a violent past.
Oh, yeah.
Well before Penny, he'd pulled a gun on a woman.
In the broad light of day.
And demanded that she
come with him.
Nothing happened because the police intervened. But what if they hadn't?
I saw the potential for violence in him. But I would be wrong to say I saw in him a Teresa Halbach. I didn't.
And so I asked him if this case had shaken his confidence in his judgment the way it had for Penny.
At first, I tried to figure out what in the world did we do wrong. And I pretty much came to the conclusion that...
At least as far as the courts were concerned.
We did get it right. And we still got a bad result. That's going to be a problem as long as humans judge other human activity. We're not always going to get it right.
That's actually the one thing we can be certain of, he says.
But cases like Avery are rare. I was 25 years on the bench and 15 years or more as a lawyer before that, and I don't think I've ever seen one quite like Stephen Avery.
He says Stephen Avery is an outlier. He's the lesson you don't learn.
It's like I was fishing last spring in Sanibel, on Sanibel Island, and I was in up to my waist trying to fly casting for snook.
It's a kind of fish.
And all of a sudden, this rather dark shape swam right by me, about 8 feet long. And I thought to myself, that's a bull shark. And here I am waist deep. And this shark swam maybe a foot away from me as he went by. What if he'd bumped into me?
Yeah.
What are the odds of this happening? But, you know, life is like that. We face the unexpected, the unknown. And
but you're not going to never go fishing there again, are you?
Oh, no. No, that wouldn't keep me from going fishing.
Then again, the judge didn't get bitten. I kept thinking over and over at the end of this, like, the Halbach family. How do they move on after something like this?
Did you call them?
I tried. I reached out to a couple of the family members, but I never heard back.
And what about Penny?
Well, she and Tom sold the chocolate shop and moved to Chicago.
Well, I'm retired. So right now I do a lot of volunteer work. Mm-hmm. Center on Wrongful Convictions, Children's Hospital. I volunteer at the Morton Arboretum, and so a variety of things.
And altogether, she seems to be doing just fine.
I mean, I question much more. I question things a lot more. Yeah, I think there's much more doubt. And I think I'm much more comfortable living with uncertainty. I've kind of had, I mean, I have to be.
Producer Pat Walters. For more information on anything that you heard in this hour, visit radiolab.org. Thanks to Pat, thanks to Lulu, and all the producers who helped us with this episode. And thank you guys for listening. So that was the story as we told it back in 2013. A couple years later, Netflix released a documentary series called Making a Murderer. It's a really deep dive into a part of the story that we only mentioned towards the end, and rather quickly, which is the conviction of Stephen Avery for the murder of Teresa Halbach. Now, we sort of talked about it based on our best understanding of the evidence at the time. Making a Murderer goes really, really deep, 10 hours deep into this question. And there are some details that they uncover, many, many details, that made us think differently about how we understood that aspect of the story and how we presented it. Here's Pat with more detail.
So let me just walk you through real quick a few of the things that are important to that part of the story, given the way that we told it in our original piece. First thing is the confession. We say that, you know, Stephen was arrested for this murder, and then his nephew came forward and confessed. Turns out that that confession is not a very straightforward piece of evidence. It came from his 16-year-old nephew, who has a very low IQ and a fourth grade reading level, that the nephew didn't come forward exactly, but rather the police pulled him out of class, questioned him many times without an attorney, asked him hundreds of very leading questions. And the kicker of that part of it is that the story that he told about all of those awful things that happened in the bedroom, there's no actual physical evidence to back up any of it. So that's the confession. The other thing is the context in which this whole thing is happening. Steve had filed a huge $36 million civil suit against the county right after he'd been exonerated. It was going really well. Some major evidence against the county had come out. This is what was happening when Teresa Halbach's body was found in Stephen Avery's backyard. So when we said Stephen Avery claimed that he was framed by the police, there's actually a little more teeth to that statement than you might have assumed when you listened to our story originally.
And there's lots, lots more, because the filmmakers spent 10 years on this. They find out things that make you question the evidence the police used to convict Stephen Avery, and it made Pat start to wonder if Avery should have ever been convicted at all. So he called up the filmmakers.
Hello.
Hi, Pat. This is Moira.
And hi, Laura.
Hi, Pat.
Their names are Moira Demos and Laura Ricciardi.
Sure.
And he basically asked them,
do you think Stephen Avery is innocent?
I mean, one of the many things I learned through this decade-long experience is, you know, the humility to accept that I don't know.
We don't think the truth emerged here with respect to the Halbach case. We don't know what happened to her. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. that we're convinced of Stephen Avery's innocence or that was even of concern to us.
You know, I think of it as, you know, I don't know whether it's the carrot or the sort of cardboard rabbit that's on the dog track that's, you know, it's making the dogs run. I mean, it's the engine that gets this story going, but it's the story that's the point, not the not the thing that we know that people are interested in.
Clearing Stephen Avery or Brendan Dassey's name was never our objective.
You know, one of the themes in the series is the danger of a rush to judgment. And, you know, we now see that in 2015 in the responses to the series, you know, people are being very quick to name suspects, to spout opinions about who did it. And
but I feel like it just makes me wonder, like, if, like, you spend a week learning about something, and then at the end of the week, you say, okay, now I'm going to say something about what I know. Or you spend a month thinking about something, or 3 months. And at the end of it, you have to say something.
Well, I actually think that's one of the points of the series. I do understand how that's hard to grapple with. And I think we are trying to challenge the viewer to deal with how hard it is to embrace ambiguity. Perhaps you can never reach a place of certainty, but you should put some energy into it. So if we let go of certainty and, you know, demand a system that gives you a sense of reliability, at least, mm-hmm. you know, that can be a goal that can maybe alleviate some of those terrible feelings.
Thanks again to reporter Pat Walters, and of course to filmmakers Laura Ricciardi and Moira Demos.
Tom Bernson calling.
Penny Bernson calling.
Radio Lab is produced by Jana Bumrat.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Thorne Wheeler,
Pat Walters, Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Molly Webster, Melissa O'Donnell, Dalen Keefe,
Lynn Levy, and Andy Mills, with help from Lulu Miller,
Meg Bowles, Douglas Q. Smith, Kelsey Padgett, and Megan Tant.
End of message.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.